I win the prize for the shortest title in the conference programme, and I really am going to talk about Earth. It's not some sort of meaning of some sense different than that. I really am trying to think about the notion of Earth and its multiple resonances, and what I'm going to present today is a part of what might be the kind of more historical conceptual work around that. And part of the reason I'm interested in this is because of a slight disillusionment with what has happened in geography, which was a discipline I was in for 11 years before I moved back into political science. And this is particularly around the notion of geopolitics, because geopolitics, it seems to me, is increasingly becoming effectively big politics or kind of global politics. It's a particular scalar way of thinking about these questions. And that you still get these kind of armchair strategists coming up with their grand plans for understanding and shaping the world. And critical geopolitics scholars then offer the kind of analysis of those sorts of strategies and interlinked relations of capital, state power, nationalism, territory, and so on. But even I think that critical geopolitics work tends to think of geopolitics as global or world politics. But can we rethink geopolitics by the etymological root of it, of earth politics, the geo in the geopolitics? And can we do that? It's the second part of the question for progressive political purposes, given the ways that it's been done in different ways in the past. Geopolitics does really mean the politics of the geo, and geo gets variously rendered into English as earth, land, planet, or world. And all of those I would want to distinguish conceptually and think them through, both in their relation but their differentiation from each other. But here, what I'm going to do today is to talk about the question of the earth. Now, when we think about the question of the earth, and John Salas, the philosopher, has a good passage on this. He says that the term can mean at least three registers, although the distinction between them is not always terribly clear. The first one is the earth, capital E. The second one is an earth, of which we happen to just know one, the earth. And the third is earth, is the way we would think about it as an element in relation to water, fire, and air. And it's predominantly the latter one that I want to focus on, although that sense pervades both of the previous two. It's the material, elemental, earthy sense that I actually want to try and discuss here. Now, the word earth in English language can be traced back to Anglo-Saxon roots. The word eorth is found in a Beowulf poem, for instance, in phrases such as the eorth cellar, an earth hall, an eorth draca, an earth dragon. And there's a whole set of related terms in Germanic languages. Eorther in Old English, earther in Old Frisian, earther in Anglo-Saxon, erde in Old High German, and which these are the roots of where we get the English earth, the German erde, and the Dutch aarde. But English, of course, you'll know this, is not simply formed from Germanic roots. And the importance of the Norman conquest is linguistic, among other political, social, and economic considerations. And the marks in the language can sometimes indicate some of those other factors. You probably all know this, but this is an example I regularly use with my students. At the beginning of Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe, a Saxon peasant is told there's reasons between the names given to animals and to the meat of those animals. Swine, oxen, calves are tended by Saxons, but are eaten as pork, beef, and veal by the Normans. The first set of words, of course, from Anglo-Saxon origin, the latter set from Norman French. And let me just dwell on the earth words for a moment. Shakespeare uses earth words, I think, often with a real precision. It plays a very important role in, along with the notion of land, and one of the two instances of the word territory in singular in King Lear. Lear threatens his two eldest daughters, Goneril and Regan, early in their betrayal. Know, you unnatural hags, I will have such revenge on you both that all the world shall. I will do such things, what they are yet I know not, but they shall be the terrors of the earth. And that brief passage with that relation between terror and earth is suggestive, I think, of a whole range of relations. Earth is used in elemental fashion to describe Lear's madness, as the winds blow the earth into the sea. It's used to describe Edgar when he's disguised as poor Tom, as the poor creature of earth. But there's also two uses of the earth term to refer to his youngest daughter, Cordelia, that I think are the most interesting. She first declares her good intentions to him, speaking of her search for Lear and his redemption, and calling for all blessed secrets, all you unpublished virtues of the earth, spring with my tears. So her antidote to Lear's madness, provoked by the terrors of the earth he had wished on her sisters, is her love that will bring forth the undisclosed or secret restorative herbs that the earth can provide. The love she refused to declare at the beginning of the play for Lear is proven and redeemed at the end. but it has a tragic ending. Cordelia dies, with Lear declaring she's dead as Earth. So Earth then, in a sense, is the more figurative way of thinking about the concrete nature of land politics. That's one of the key themes of that play, both in terms of Lear's own division of the kingdom between his three daughters and the men that they are married to or will become married to. But it's also, land is a key part of the subplot of the play of Duke of Gloucester and his legitimate and illegitimate sons, who will inherit his lands. So the inheritance of land or earth. Shakespeare's Richard II is also suffused with what I'd call an earth politics, a politics of land, we might even call an originary geopolitics. Richard declares that in order to fund his Irish wars, he is enforced to farm our royal realm, the revenue whereof shall furnish us for our affairs in hand. So this idea of farming the realm is important. It's a play that's filled with language of soil, land, earth and ground. But the land politics in the play, for me, goes beyond merely a kind of patriotic attachment to a particular place. There is what we might call a geopolitical economy, a political economy of land or of earth. The king is condemned for selling rights and precisely this farming of the realm. Farming meaning to farm out, to lease to tenants. So he's accused of let this land by lease. His deputies have blank charters by which they can extract revenue from the affluent landed aristocracy. And Richard's vision of the land as resource, the earth as a resource, is directly challenged by the way that John of Gaunt describes England. This is the very famous passage. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but just some parts of that passage. This royal throne of kings, this sceptred isle, this earth of majesty, this seat of Mars. Later on, this precious stone set in the silver sea, which serves in the office of a wall or as a moat defensive to a house against the envy of less happier lands. This blessed plot, this earth, this realm, this England. Later, this land of such dear, dear souls, this dear, dear land, dear for her reputation through the world, is now leased out. I die pronouncing it like to a tenement or pelting farm, that it's become this resource that can simply be exploited for those reasons. But Richard himself begins to gain this attachment back to the land, the earth of the kingdom, just as his grip on the crown is slipping away. After Gaunt's son, Henry Bolingbroke, the future Henry IV, has returned to England from his exile and is challenging Richard's rule, Richard makes an invocation when he comes back to England from Ireland, having put down the Irish rebellion. Needs must, he says, I like it well. I weep for joy to stand upon my kingdom once again. Dear earth, I do salute thee with my hand, though rebels wound thee with their horses' hooves. And then there's other passages in that whole long speech of the earth, my gentle earth, the earth shall have a feeling, this way of attachment to a particular place and a grounding, perhaps again, of his rule. And even towards the end of the play, at the deposition scene when he's losing everything, but not yet quite his life, he says, let us talk of graves, of worms and epitaphs, make dust our paper and with rainy eyes write sorrow on the bosom of the earth. Let's choose executors and talk of wills, and yet not so, for what can we bequeath save our deposed bodies to the ground? Our lands, our lives, and all are Bolingbroke's, and nothing can we call our own but death, and that small model of the barren earth, which serves as paste and cover to our bones. So there's a whole set of ways that, this is a separate project, of thinking through this kind of land, earth, territory senses in Shakespeare, to think about what we might call Shakespeare's geographies or Shakespeare's territories around this. There are other roots of what we might call earth words into the English language, though. In the French, with the Latin antecedents pertaining to earth, Frantz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth, for example, is Le Damné de la Terre. And the French terre and the Latin terra form the root of so many English words around these kinds of questions, terrestrial, terrain, the dog, the terrier, as well as the words or phrases we've taken directly into the language, terra firma, terra incognita, terra nullius. There's also another root of words into the language that may appear similar, terrare, meaning to frighten or scare away. Obviously, the direct root of words such as terror, terrorism, terrify, and so on. But there's a long-standing debate about whether territory is formed from terrare, to frighten, or terra, land, or earth. Whether it's a place around a place, a surrounding area around a particular focus or a centre, like a city, or a place from which people are warned off. There's a large literature looking at those kinds of questions. But it's interesting, I think, that the suffix of the word territorium, from which territory is most directly derived, Aurium is an interesting suffix in the language. We have this in other words, crematorium, sanatorium, auditorium, a place of something, a place around something. So having this Anglo-Saxon and therefore Germanic roots into the language alongside Latin, Norman, French ones is of course not unusual. But there's a third set of words in English deriving directly from the Greek, the geo notion, including all of the words like geography, geology, geometry, and geopolitics. But in those, what I'm concerned about is the way that we're getting increasingly detached from that element of the geo, the earth sense, and replacing it with other ideas. So geopolitics, as I said, becoming effectively global politics or big international relations. Geometry being seen as a branch of mathematics that's abstract and detached rather than genuine earth measuring. Geography is no longer earth writing, but often a loose spatial sensibility to work that could easily have been done in international relations, cultural studies, or sociology. So perhaps it's only really in geology today that we have that genuine link back to the notion of the geo. But even geology is often losing ground in universities to earth sciences, which is supposedly a broader way of conceiving some of those questions of the air, the earth, the soil, the rock, the ice, and biota being linked together. Now, there's a whole set of ways that we might think about the notion of the geo. I'm not going to be able to go through all of these in detail. I'm interested in the ways that the geo is understood within Greek thought, the way that Aristotle is one of the people that gives us a sense of the tradition that preceded him, with some of the ways that he talks about the material elements in Empedocles or in Hesiod, thinking about the way that Earth relates to these questions. Of course, for Aristotle in the Physics, the reason that heavy things fall downwards is because they are earthy, that their natural place is below. So it's important, even in someone like Aristotle, with that. There's a long discussion in the Metrologica where he talks about exhalation in the Earth and how certain things get produced by earth processes, and he talks about fossils and metals as two of the things that are produced by these particular kinds of earth processes. And some of those earth processes and some of those links to fossils and things dug from the ground are the focus of a very interesting book that just came out a couple of months ago by Geoffrey Jerome Cohen, who's a medievalist, called Stone, An Ecology of the Inhuman, where he uses stone and material mineral traces to trace a different set of ways about thinking about human connection to the environment. And I think some very interesting ways. Now, there's a whole, as I said, a whole set of ways in which Aristotle thinks about those questions. But one of the things that Aristotle begins, I think, to identify is this way that geometry is increasingly detached from the concrete physical nature of measurement of the earth, where he says that geometry as a science differs from measurement of the earth in that the latter deals with what we perceive, whereas the former deals with the unperceived. It's becoming along the route that it will become in somebody like Euclid or much later in the analytic geometry of someone like Descartes, of becoming this abstract branch of mathematics rather than the original Egyptian sense of the earth measurers who went out after the Nile had flooded every year to remark the boundaries in the fields. It's a story that we're told in Herodotus, for example. Now, I became interested in how this might extend into Greek myths of autochthony and that the politics that might come from an attachment or a rootedness into the soil. And you can see some of those if you think about how earth might relate. This would be, see somehow these might play out politically in a contemporary register if you think about how earth might relate to notions of soil, of blood and soil, or of the notion of land in notions such as homeland, fatherland, motherland, promised land, holy land, Eretz Israel, land of our fathers, and so on. So this would be one of the big cautions that I have about trying to use the geo as an element of rethinking a notion of geopolitics, is the reactionary, regressive politics that has so often gone alongside appeals to soil or land or earth as a basis for political foundation. And you can see that playing out in a number of thinkers, many of whom happen to be German, but a number of the ways in which in Carl Schmitt, in Friedrich Ratzel, in Martin Heidegger, these appeals to a particular connection to the earth or the soil go alongside that particularly unpleasant, often racial, but certainly expansionist politics of that period. So some of those kind of questions seem to me to be important to think through in a number of registers, the fear or the worry about a kind of a reactionary geopolitics that might go alongside those kinds of questions. Heidegger does it, for example, both in his reading of Friedrich Hölderlin's poetry, but also in a fairly famous passage where he talks about Van Gogh's painting of Heidegger thinks peasant shoes, although people tend to say that these may actually have been Van Gogh's own boots that he used to walk in an urban setting. But for Heidegger, these show us a particular attachment to the soil, to the earth, to the land, and so on. What I'm interested in then is whether there is some kind of possibility for escaping that reactionary politics on the one hand, and the problem which geographers are long familiar with, the geographical determinism, that the geography of a place can tell you something very concrete about the politics. You find that in Robert Kaplan's recent book, Revenge of Geography. He keeps saying, I'm not a geographical determinist, but that does seem to condition a lot of the ways that he thinks about those kinds of questions. So what I'm interested in is whether there is a potential for doing this that doesn't fall into either of those two traps, the regressive politics or the geographical determinism. Whether there's an alternative way of thinking about politics in relation to Earth around those questions. Whether there are resources in work such as Deleuze and Guattari's Geophilosophy, Elizabeth Gross with her notion of geopower, which she conceives as a clash of competing forces of which human relations of power are but a small subset of those questions. Whether there's something in Nietzsche's work around geophilosophy to open up different ways of thinking about those questions. Whether such a politics of the earth could take account of the power of natural processes, of resources, of the dynamics of human environment, the interrelation of objects outside of human intervention, the relation between the biosphere, atmosphere, and the lithosphere, and the complex interrelations that produce, continually transform, and rework the question of territory and state spatial strategies. So how would thinking about geopower, it's Elizabeth Gross's term, a reconfigured geopolitics, or even a geometrics that was genuinely about the measuring of the earth and all of the processes, how would that work if we took the earth, the air and the subsoil, questions of land, terrain, territory, earth processes and understandings of the world, if we took those as the central terms at stake in there rather than some kind of addition to that, rather than a looser sense of the global, could we reconfigure geopolitics along those lines? Such a politics of the earth might hope to be appropriate to dealing with the challenges of what's being called the Anthropocene. Now that, of course, is a much larger project. It's one that's going on with a number of people, and my work might be some way of contributing to those debates. But what I've tried to say today is how a more narrowly conceived political conceptual thinking about the notion of the earth might be a useful step in that work. Thank you.
Thank you very much.